Well, here we go. Can you hear me? No.
Here we go again. Why don't you...
Much closer, yeah. Is this better? Still closer. Is this better?
No.
It thinks it's on, but it's not really on.
Yeah,
you
lift it up a little bit.
Okay, is that better? Well, I'll shout too. You have to shout. I might as well shout. Can you hear me? So I'm trying to imagine what group dialogue might be. It's obviously a session where you're going to make comments and questions and I'm going to respond. But what could group dialogue be? Yes. At least it might be that you could comment on each other's comments. So if you have something like that to say and argue with the other person or answer the question, I wish you would do that so that we have done our duty that is shared in the program. You're going to say something.
I had a question.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
We're ready for your question.
Okay, if you come closer, it'll be easier. You won't have to repeat it.
You could even take this mic.
Okay. I said I have that mic.
Only Janet can have that mic.
Okay. Jean was introduced at the philosophy conference by another philosopher who said, Jean has restored to us our dot, 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 dot. And everyone loved it. And Jean was later talking about how if you completely understand the precision of a philosopher's thinking, not whether you agree with it or not, but if you are completely precisely involved with the every intricacy of that philosopher's thinking, then you can stand in the spaces between that philosopher's thoughts and dip into the self-sensing that that philosopher's thoughts were arising from and get more from that place. So I don't have a specific question except that that fascinates me. And would you please talk more?
You have microphone.
Well, it occurs to me that you can do that with anybody. What we want to do is to stand where we think that person stands. And since we're us, we can never really do that literally. But given that I stay me, I try to stand where whoever I'm trying to understand stands. And then I look around there. So if I have somebody whose viewpoint, beliefs, emotions are totally apart and different, then I'm especially interested in standing where they stand. If they can, they're usually not willing to help me with that. But if they are, it's all the better. I don't really grasp why so few people feel like that. Most of every issue that I find people who aren't at all interested in the other side of the issue. Why a decent person who likes themselves could have that viewpoint. It never occurs to them to wonder about that. And to me, that's the most fascinating thing. Because what I know about the other side is just words. I don't really know why somebody would say that, want that, feel that, believe that. And that's what I want to know. Now that's especially true in a philosopher, because philosophers, as I tried to say, derive their concepts from such a place. They derive their concepts from living, from experiencing, from practicing in some context, in some situation, in some juncture. And they usually write a lot to get you to come with them to that juncture. And that's what I want to do. I want to go with them. And I lose them and I have to read it 10 times. You can't read philosophy, just sit down and read it. Because all the words mean something else and you don't know what they mean. So you have to read it many times until you get the hang of how the words work. But when you finally get to where they stand, that's the fascinating place. Then you say, oh, this is where you got these concepts. And I do the same there that I said earlier. I want to know what the concepts are doing, what they're articulating, what they're speaking from. And then I know that philosophy, and I can teach that philosophy, but I get so much more than just the conclusions of that philosophy, if you see what I mean. Once I'm there, I see all kinds of things that I wouldn't have seen and that are not part of that philosophy. Okay.
Let me make a comment there, too. This is the same process with theory, of course, and also with clients, that the question of, instead of what's wrong with this picture, of course that's an important question too, but how would this make sense? How can I put myself in the place where that deeply makes sense? And then all kinds of things come from there.
Maybe there's only going to be one question.
Oh, no.
No, what I mean is if we go back and forth enough, there won't be time for it. No, I didn't want to. It's just that I have still another comment. I realize that I'm speaking to a group, half of which probably do not think of reflecting back the way I do and the way I was trained. Reflecting back to me is precisely that. I'm saying, I think this is what you're speaking from, this is what you're saying, but I know I probably don't have it right. And then the person appreciates my effort and says, oh, no, where did you get that? What I mean is this and this and this. And then I say, oh, and now I think I know. So then I say back, I see this and this and this. And then the person says, yeah, but you didn't get this part right. See, this part goes like that. Oh, I say, this part goes like that. Ha! Now we're together for 30 seconds, right? And we really are together. Because while he's going to go on in a way that I could never have imagined myself, still I can understand how he went on from that spot where we were together. And so this, what Min said is why I believe in listening. It makes the contact. I know there are other reasons for it. Somebody had a question.
My question, it's not really, I'd like you to talk about intentionality because it comes from what happened with you. When I asked my question earlier about your talking, and as you focused on me, I had a very powerful, visceral sense of, you really want to understand.
Mm.
Your people are saying these things better than I can. I really keep going like that. Yes, the intention there, the intention to really understand the other person is more important than how fast you understand. If they get onto the fact that you're trying to understand, you can get it wrong 5 times, it's just fine. The surprise is that you want to understand. For some reason, nobody does. I think it's very strange, because when you're arguing with somebody, if you don't understand where they're coming from, and they obviously don't understand where you're coming from, then you're both really talking to somebody that's not even in the room, doesn't even exist. Why talk to somebody that doesn't exist? I mean, why is that better than wondering, you know, talking to you, of course I wonder what you really mean. To me it seems like of course. But I know this is true all over the place, but when a kid understands that you want to know, which is surprising, well, that's different. Then, well, they will tell you. And they'll be in touch inside with it also. Yes?
I have another comment on that.
Yes.
I want to say also that this is where the relationality comes in, that it's a powerful experience for me to feel like my therapist really wants to know. This must be important. I must be important. We must be connected. This is enlivening for him as well as for me. something is happening here. There are innumerable relational implications that somebody would want them to understand. That they can understand that I'm on their wavelength, that this funny thing that I'm talking about could be understood, that I'm understandable. All of that, much, much more, is in there relationally.
This is what a group dialogue is.
I have read a survey a while back about what makes psychotherapy work.
A survey what?
What makes psychotherapy work? What are the qualities of
work?
A therapist?
What makes it work?
That makes it work. And the number one quality was caring, which I think is what you're talking about in terms of attention.
Number
caring.
One quality was
caring.
Caring.
Oh, caring, yes.
Yeah.
Which
I think is what you were doing with
her.
And that, I understand, comes from the French word meaning to carry.
Well, I think it's true that there's caring in it, all right. But if you make it sound too good, then I think it becomes too distant from what we can rely on. I think also this, all the things that are said about reflection make it seem hard. To me, as soon as I realize that I want to know what you really mean, I get all free from my own stuff. You know, before I was, and I don't automatically listen, but there are always people who have to, often in a group, people will stop me and say, Gene, wait, she's trying to say, and you're not listening. I'm always grateful when people do that to me. So I don't want you to think that I'm this ideal person who always listens. Far from it, I get all involved and I have my own feelings, and then I realize that, wait a minute, you don't yet know where this person is. And then trying to understand where they're coming from is a complete liberation. I don't have to say the right thing, I don't have to know any answers, I don't have to be a good person, I don't have to even care. I just have to wonder what they really mean. So it's a lot easier, but there is care in it, there's no question. And there is this relation.
Yeah, and that listening is a deep discipline. It's very hard to kind of put aside all of the wisdom and the knowledge and everything that we know and be open to something else. And that could also be my focus on the focusing. Listening inside. So listening is a big deal.
I think to me that it goes beyond caring. I think what's closer to me to what you're talking about is caring curiosity. Because caring alone doesn't have necessarily the ingredient of I don't know where this person is.
Yes. I remember someone years ago made this to me unforgettable statement. She said, anybody who cares for me has to understand me exactly. Right? Yes, I agree. Yes.
But I want to add to that word. The word caring, I think, comes from the French, meaning to carry the burden. So you have to really know the burden that you're into it. Help
yes.
this person. Metaphor being like helping them carry their cross.
Yes.
Metaphor,
yes.
To go
yes.
get into it.
I like that.
Great. Yes. Yes. Oh, you're counting on people or am I?
No, you are.
Oh, go ahead. I'll be back.
I just like to ask the three of you what you think the role of the therapist's self-sensing is during the session. We've been talking a lot about the client self-sensing, and I'm just wondering if the therapist self-sensing has a role.
You mean you assume that I'm usually a disembodied, abstract sort of idiot caught up here, and I don't know what to mean.
I wouldn't say that.
No, forgive me, he's a friend of mine. It's like I don't understand anything if I don't have my self-sense level with me. Because that's where I understand something from. So, self-sense could be used in that special way where everything has to stop while I go in, and a special datum forms there, and that's what you meant. And of course, there are times in therapy when I have to do that. Sometimes I have to say, I need a couple minutes now. Just let's be quiet while I find what's going on here with me. Most of the time I don't have to do that, I can do it quietly. There are times like that, sure, when it gets murky, when I don't know why, when I'm bothered and I don't know why. But most of the time, I have to be in touch with the felt sense level to appreciate what's going on.
What I like to say is that focusing-oriented therapy is not what the client can do. The client maybe can't do anything about going inside or reaching this level. Focusing-oriented therapy is about what the therapist does, the therapist's ability to go to that level. And then I think of the felt sense of the therapist being the most important thing. And one of my students said, Mary said, that it's the felt sense of the client and one's own self sense, the self sense that the client is talking about, and then one's own self sense of the client. And I would add, it's also our self sense of the interaction, the between that's always there.
I want to focus as much as I can, my whole being, into being with the other person, and just let my felt sense be with that. And then different things may happen. There might be like something distracting me, and my felt sense will tell me about that, and I might ask it to wait and clear a space so I can be with the person. Often, the felt sense will tell me what's happening with the person, and I can reflect that and then see how close that is. But it seems just to take care of itself. It's like the main thrust for me is just I want to hear and be with you and hear where you're coming from.
The use of the word intentionality a while ago really piqued my interest, because I'm wondering what role
Well, what exactly do you mean? Because that word means lots of things.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, what's stirring in me is that when I heard the word intentionality, it triggered in me this sense of passivity in terms of the unfolding of the existence. And where does intentionality and directionality...
Now, here would be an example of... I can't really expect to understand what she's saying if I don't let myself feel her connections. Because she's using all these big words that I'm familiar with, about five or six different meanings. So, and I might need you to say that again slowly, but you were there.
When I heard the word intentionality, I heard something that suggested something active within the person.
Actively, what a person?
Within the person,
yes.
having a role
yes.
in the process.
Ah, well, okay.
And yet I'm not sure where in the philosophy there is room for that.
Yes, well, that's right. In this philosophy, any living process is fundamentally to begin with active. So that by the time you get from the plants to the animals to the human being or to something that's passive, that's already a special way of being active, right? You're sitting on yourself. It's not a natural process to be passive. But all that said, see, philosophy is on a different level, so you can't ever just simply take something that makes good sense in a situation and zip over the philosophy. It becomes a different question. What you really mean, yes. Yes, intention is active, And to me, it is the continuance of the basic life process. That's why I think when my client starts criticizing me for the first time, I know we're getting somewhere. I may still have to say, oh, I'm sad I hurt your feelings, and blah, blah, blah. Or I may say, I care about what happened, tell me more, or something. But I'm glad that she's not passive anymore, right? That's not how you meant it? The intention that she was talking about is an active desire to understand, yeah?
Where does that come from, that intention? The intention to understand.
Well, that's what Rob was talking about. The way we're taught the concepts, everything is a passive reception, and you have to wonder where anything active comes from. No, why don't you wonder where passive comes from? That's the unnatural thing. That's where our life is getting defeated by something that we've interjected and stick on ourselves. And now we say we can't dare to be active. And then when we get free to do the next living, it's active. But it is a special kind of active to want to understand this person. That when you're coming out somewhere, you say, what do you mean, right? It's pretty special. But if we're going to connect it to the philosophy, it goes the other way around. So let's ask, what overcomes the inner self stoppage so that somebody can be active, where many of us are not, right? How do we get past Sigmund Freud? That he's often right, we know that. Now, how do we get past there? Yes.
Everything,
yes.
And that has something to do with Freud.
Yes, I wasn't at all clear.
It has to do with like a self-deceiving process.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering how you think about the things that focusing doesn't help, how you understand those things.
Well, I will say that I cannot predict what focusing won't help. All I know is that focusing is this incredible, powerful thing that dissolves one thing after another, and then when you finally have done it for some time, you realize that certain things were left. And Robert Lee makes a specialty out of that. He's calling it changing the unchangeable. You know. So I know that focusing and interaction is much more powerful. So much more so that I'm saying, don't do focusing. If you have to do nothing else, don't do it at all. Do focusing with everything else you can get. That's my answer. And don't be discouraged, because this is relatively new. It's just a few generations since Freud. Right? Now, how does Freud come in here? Because he has the kind of theory that I'm trying to change. He has the kind of theory where the person is a machine. Certain infantile energies are in there, and they're always going to be in there, and what you are is a combination of those energies, and however that is, it's not going to change. And he didn't think psychoanalysis would change it. He was just interested. And that's why it's called originally it was called analysis. He was more interested in how it works. And it's true that if you figure out how you work, you get a lot more control, and people do get a lot of advantage from just understanding. But he didn't think those things would change much. The alliance with the analyst changes the energy balance so that some of them can come up from the unconscious, but he doesn't say anything about them changing. And too much of it is still like that. And I'm saying I wouldn't want to practice without having that feeling, because too often it helps me to know what he said. But a lot of the time, fortunately, it doesn't fit. Did I answer?
Partly. I guess when I think of Freud in this context, I think of the idea of a motivation actually stay stuck and to be
word.
Yes.
It's almost like a competing it. Like
yes,
it,
but
like
it's
like a life force or an it that actually has a more destructive plan.
I don't see how that's different. How is a life force different from what I was saying?
No, a life force is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I guess when I think of Freud, I think of him opposing like a life force and a death force.
I see. No, you're quite right. Yes, yes, of course. But when you trace his death force, his death instinct back, it turns out that he assumed it at the center of his theory to begin with. At the center of his theory, where I would want some living thing, I don't care if it's an incident of your grandmother, anything whatsoever, as long as it lives, he put homeostasis at the center. 1911, the papers, a great paper. But he's already got a long footnote where he says people object to this, but they're wrong. He put the homeostatic scheme at the center. Well, homeostasis is the death instinct. 30 years later, he's still got this problem that everything is supposed to drive to even out. And evening out for him was death. And life was making complications, and death was evening out. But he put the evening out at the center of his theory. I don't know if you want that. I don't believe that what I call motivation exists to stay stuck. And it's true that there is a psychoanalytic short circuit on that point. People are forever saying, you know, I must want to. And instead of looking for how they do feel, they substitute this notion, this insult to themselves. I must want to defeat myself. Well, yeah, sure, but want to defeat yourself is shorthand for some real thing that's there. Go look, see what you got there. Then you find that, yeah, you are. It's all true, but it's short circuits finding it. Actually, I'm scared of what will happen if I go forward. So I don't have a motivation to stay stuck. I have a scare. But you can call it a motivation to stay stuck. But it's never directly a death motivation, I think. Yes, now I have the point. Yeah, sure.
I just want to add that whenever I say that I'm doing this because of this, that I'm saying, like, the pen fell because of gravity. Yeah. I don't know. I won't know why I'm doing what I do unless I go there. And that means going underneath the concept that I have about the story I tell myself.
Yes. Yes, I could say, for me, I have an upstairs and I have a downstairs. And I think one of the things that made things for me is when I early on decided to honor both of them, but not allow them to fight. So my upstairs intellect is free. It can think anything, no matter how horrendous or wrong or whatever it is. And my downstairs is free to feel whatever it's going to feel. And it's always interesting if they disagree, but they can't stop each other because they don't replace each other. They can't supply what the other one supplies. So this may think it knows brilliantly clearly why I'm doing this itself. But if I don't go downstairs, I don't know. Wait, I've left somebody hanging over here. Yeah.
There just seems to be some
Well, at the risk of punning, I don't want those to be the same. Yes, 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 and you're right too. I am saying that even though the repetition compulsion, which is to say the force of the old way that I was affected when I was a child, which I still can't seem to get past, seems to be a force. Actually, we should wonder why it keeps repeating, not how we get out of it. Because in order to do what indeed it does when it has me stuck, in order to keep me stuck, it has to refresh keeping me stuck every day, or every time that comes up, or every minute, because we are constant self-forming. And for it to self-form itself the same every time is really a puzzle. Why does it do that? Can I get you to wonder not why novelty is possible? Not why therapy works, but why we even need it. I mean, why are we repeating this job when we have to go to the trouble of doing it freshly? I mean, it's like, you know, we used to get punished in school. You have to write, I am lazy 400 times or something. It's so boring. It's really to be wondered that the same is the same. And I'm saying here, that really is an exception. Because there is no same, in fact. Each time it happens on a different day, in a different moment, in a different context, and it really isn't the same. It's a kind of process in which it looks the same to an observer, and it keeps the same in a certain sense, but yet each bit of repetition is different. So am I doing it? Oh, yeah, and that's where interaction should come in. Right? If I'm already different because I'm relating to you, then that isn't exactly that. Although, it will. Yes?
Can't hear you.
Can you hear what you're saying?
Is there a repetition in the self sense? The self sense each time,
yes,
would be the same. Very nice question.
Yes, a lovely question. Of course, the self sense is all fresh and new every minute too. It's always in the present. So, for instance, if you're working with a trauma, you don't want to have the person re-traumatize themselves by just reliving it, just repeating it. It needs to be in part of a wider thing that's going on. Hopefully, your interaction. Part of a wider felt sense. So if it's felt in a present whole bodiness, that would be the felt sense. So I want to say that what we're calling the felt sense is always fresh and never a repetition. Oh, sure. Even, you know, if I stay a little while with a felt sense, it will change some. And then if I say, oh, that's what it is, the felt sense changes. And yet it doesn't change into something else, it changes into its own next. Is that related to what you mean?
I'm not sure if it's within one person.
Or if I have a certain stuck problem, every time I go to it, I get the same felt sense. Is that what you mean? I didn't hear the last thing you said.
No, I don't say that the same, but you, like, if you see, as a therapist, you see a person every week, and they come to even a little bit different person, then you see the relationship between those different, even if they are evolving.
You tell me first what you said, you can answer, but then tell me.
I'll do a reflection and see if you can hear it at the same time. So I'm hearing that if I'm seeing somebody in therapy like week after week after week, and each time the felt sense is a little different, do I see a relationship, a sense of relationship across these different felt senses? Is that right?
Yes, that's the question.
Okay.
Thank you, I'm sure. And hopefully further in, right? Further in than last week. Further in, maybe I need to define. But would you agree that not only is there a relationship, but you get discouraged if there is not some kind of development,
yes,
some kind of movement there, right? And a felt sense should, according to me, always move. Right? Just the having of a felt sense is already some kind of shift. Oh, that. Well, if you have the same one again and again, it doesn't bring much of a change, right? So then what do? Well, we need to make it fresher or broader. We need to bring Lynn in to say something relational so that it can't stay the same. Right? Yes. Yes.
Let me
sure.
add. I'll put my two cents in here. When we have a client where the felt sense always seems to be the same in a certain place, there's a kind of stuckness, and oh, I always get to that same thing, that same heavy stuff, whatever it is. Then I look to myself as the therapist. Well, what's stuck in me there? Because if I can unstick me, and we're a team or we're partners, then that's going to unstick the whole thing. So I have a wonderful thing there where I can look to my own felt sense and why that's stuck there, and if I get that unstuck, the whole thing can unstick.
That seems very good. I would add to it, and you can look for whatever else you got there that you might want to use interactionally. Not only where you're contributing to the stuck, or whatever else you have, curiosity, anger, impatience, concern for the person. You know, I want my person, I often feel like my person's lawyer kind of. And we don't usually want that. We want somebody who listens, never mind. But there are times when it helps to say, you know, as your lawyer, I want, anyway, something more is needed, yes. Well, say it, since you heard it more clearly. What is space in the process model? Well, I don't hear very well way over there. No, you don't have to say it. Yeah, come and say it up here.
Yes, come. Come,
Janet.
Several times, Rob was saying,
Rob says the sentence that our old way of thinking is about separate units in time and space.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about that sentence, I'm thinking about the space part, and I'm interested in the space, and the part about standing in the space between the thoughts, I'm actually interested in the notion of space.
Yes.
And I know I need to study the process model for years to come, but
yes.
There's a way you could say a few words
now I get the question.
About space,
right.
And I know today's project is how does the philosophy create new theory for psychotherapy, new theoretical concepts for psychotherapy. So how does that work?
Well, the way I understand it, there is not this direct connection like that. The way I understand it, philosophy lets you make concepts. Then once you know how to make this different kind of concept, you can make it about something from therapy. So in the process model, it really turns out, it developed that way for me, I wasn't expecting it, but later it made sense, that space is really the possibilities in front of us. Moving creatures. Space is possibilities. Spaces implied behavior sequences. When you have only one behavior, the way I was talking this morning, there is no space. But if you have 50 implicit behaviors that you might do, they're all there in the implied. And then there's one thing you need, which you maybe can't do. But they're all, that's a space. So the space, the first space is a filled space. It's a behavior space. It's a possibilities space. Now, the empty space that we are used to talking about is a geometry space. It's a perfectly artificial system that doesn't actually exist, of points which an observer connects. So it's a being outside. So supposedly, we're outside the universe looking at it, and it occurs as information at points. And these points don't know anything about each other, and they don't care about each other, and they don't relate. The observer connects the points, relates the points. So the observer relates here and there. And then they make time look like that too. So that, and I'm making fun of it, but it's very useful. I wouldn't have a microphone if it weren't for that system. So don't think I'm putting that system down. I'm only saying that is an artificial human creation, which is enormously important and powerful. Just don't assume that we live inside of it. It lives inside of us. There is a wider understanding which honors it and legitimates it and explains it and derives it and doesn't lose it at all. Okay, so there's his philosophy. Now, how are we going to get the therapy from there? Well, one thing is that we don't surely, and you know, you all know that, we don't surely have to consider a person as a machine that operates in this time-space point system. It's clear that the person I'm talking to is looking at me, and no machine can do that. And so already, anything we have in practice from the moment of sitting down is already beyond the system of these mechanics, including the illusion of a Freudian machinery that I can't change, that's always going to do the same thing. However much we live that way, we have to go in and see, what is that there? What do we have really got there? Okay. And now space. Oh, well, space is so interesting. But it's this, for example, we used to teach focusing by having a person stand somewhere still and having another person approach them. Surely you know that. And it turns out that space is part of your body. You can let another person come just that close, and then you have to force yourself to let them come any closer. There's a very distinct place where your body is. It's not just inside your skin. And you always be able to think of things like that. All I can say is that the philosophy would let you articulate those things, would let you write about those things or think about those things. You wouldn't have to let those things be mysterious puzzles because we live in geometry. Yes? Is what possible in the field behavior space?
True creativeness, or is behavior space
creativeness?
Creativeness.
Or is behavior space simply all of the combinations?
Well, that's right. These questions are very helpful. See, every time I say no, each occurrence of any living thing is creative. So I turn your question upside down and I say, how come most of what we observe is repetitious in biology, when you claim that each time it's a fresh formulation? It's not the creative that's puzzling. Yes, of course it can be creative. The batter stands at the plate, let's say, with the bat, ready to swing, in case the ball comes and looks right. If he swings, if it doesn't look right, he strikes out, so that's bad. Meanwhile, the ball isn't here yet. But he's jumping back and forth and doing a lot of behaving, and all he's really doing with all his behaving is getting ready for the swing, which he might not do. And then the ball will come some strange way.
Yeah, but why is behavior space
Oh, okay. Well, really, I'm denying that it's empty.
Right. So there's emptiness in it as well. I mean, places for new behaviors, not
No. You're still making room for new behavior have to have its own empty. And I'm saying no. No, any behavior that it repeats will be fresh. And if the environment is a little different, or if the body's a little different, it will be new. It'll come out new. If I'm typing on my computer and the keyboard shifts slightly, I type garbage. You follow me? I don't type the letters I'm implying, I type something else. Excuse me. Yes, yes, yes. See, all my words mean the opposite if I don't work right. No, I don't mean by possibilities that these are the fixed possibilities and the animal or the guy has to do one of them. I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying the possibilities that are already formed will come out new too. Because he's not quite identically the same and the environment is not quite. So if the environment is a little different, you don't notice. It's the same thing. If the environment is very different, he might get stuck. But if he doesn't, some new thing will come up.
And the source of novelty is life itself? Is that what you're saying?
The source of?
Novelty.
Novelty.
Is life itself.
Well, you still, no, I'm saying the source of what happens is life itself. And why you think you need a source of novelty is because they taught us that everything was a machine. So now you want a source for the novelty. But novelty is life. It's fresh. If you're looking at it, you see it's alive. Excuse me. No, come back. Did I answer it? It's so helpful to me if you all notice what is happening here. It's like I said space. And I wanted to have a full space, not the empty space of geometry. But space so inherently means the empty space that we had to talk for a while about having room in that full space for something new. You know, it was like it was all covered and taken, and the new thing couldn't push in there because it needed. And I said, no, it's this, the possibilities themselves are new every time, and they can be a little different. So that was fine. So then she says, so are you saying life is the source of novelty? And I realized, that's right. I spent years trying to find the source of novelty until it occurred to me to turn it upside down and say, what's the source of why you need novelty? What's the source of why you think novelty is the exception? What's the source of why you think novelty is impossible? And of course I knew the source was that I was taught this machinery notion of what exists. So then, anything new is special, because everything happens all at the same time. But if you look at the repetitions, they aren't really repetitions, they're novel too. But it's something to explain why it looks repetitious. And so I'm turning it upside down again. You know, I'm saying, you need a source for why novelty is such a question.
Well, I'm not really working off empty geometric space, I'm thinking more of a mathematical possibility space, which could have
yes, and there too, we were taught that the emptiness is an infinity of possibilities. And it's a lie. The emptiness is no possibilities. The possibility you have to begin with. If you give me a blank piece of paper, I don't have all the possibilities that Monet has. Monet can see possibilities that I don't have those. You have to come with the possibility to what you want to do. The blank sheet doesn't give you. But in geometry, it's right to say that it is an infinity of lines. So if you treat Monet's line as a geometric line, then it's one of the infinite lines that make up the plane. But you ain't going to get any kind of line unless you come with it.
I'd like to interrupt here for a minute because I feel like I'm the bad guy. We want to let you go by 5 o'clock, and it's it's about 7 minutes to five, and I'm wondering if we could have comments about just what has struck you about the day. This will be what you have on your program as our closing remarks. So if you'll help us with the closing remarks by just saying what you're going to bring home today, and we could do that for about 7 minutes. I'd like to let you go by 5 o'clock. Anybody with what you... Go ahead. You recognize people.
Oh, okay.
So, my big take-home for the day...
Yes?
Something I thought was very elegant. When you were talking about making a temporary place for the client to be, and I think we were thinking of a hut, a tent, you know, home, the feeling of home. And we've also been talking about space a lot, but that struck me as having a lot to do with time. And I'm reading recently about this transition theory in anthropology, where in the liminal space between change, like man and father, it's a very dangerous space. Like, I guess cultures across the board create ritual in that space to sort of make protection. And that hut struck me as one of the things that you're sort of creating ritual.
Yes.
And you're, but it's a time thing. It's like almost in that moment, like you're holding the person. And without religion, it struck me as being almost a, like a sacred ritual.
Yes.
That's beautiful. And we could take that your image home with us too. That's very nice.
And it is a hut. It's not a home. It's a hut. It's a place.
Yes,
temporary place.
Anybody else?
I'm struck by heroism. It's not a word
heroism
we've used today, but Kurt Goldstein said the only true heroism given to people is the tolerance of ambiguity. And I see that in the panel and focusing movement in general, to tolerate the ambiguity of new concepts, letting yourself go, being uncertain where you are, being ungrounded. It requires a lot of heroism, and I'd like to applaud that quality of focusing movement.
Yeah, I'd like to.
But it's not ungrounded if I know that it's a place where something comes. So I confess that it's not as courageous as you.
There's a term Donnell Stern uses about courting surprise, and that's what comes to me about ambiguity. It's this courting surprise place.
I think listening and being open to change is, of course, it's huge. And if you look at what happened, say, with Copernicus, it took hundreds of years for Europe to listen to him. And he didn't know what he meant when he spoke. And the listening took hundreds of years. So, and a lot of things happened. So it does take a lot of strength and a lot of heroism to be open to just listening. Mm.
Yeah.
When I first met Gene and began working...
A little louder for
when me. When I first met Gene and began working with him,
this business of what you're going to take home is some elegant way of getting compliments.
Well, you may or may not think of this one as a compliment.
Why not?
I felt many concepts kind of sat on the table, and people often had to pound into the table in order to make their seat quite solid. And when I began understanding your concepts, I remember telling you once, it's like you put concepts on wheels. Now today, I'm sensing something else developing.
it's like the new concept that I felt you were presenting. It's like an ATV, which is an all-terrain vehicle. And so I'm sensing how not only does it apply to the ordinary, everyday thinking, but I'm sensing how it can begin to apply to the realm of energy and experiencing of energy and of the place of that moves in called the spiritual.
Mm. Yeah. Good.
I think within 5 years the energy work will be completely public and everybody will be talking about it. So I think what I know that you have to say there is important. It isn't just another technology that can be misused, like focusing or anything else can be misused, that it's part of a wider understanding. Just the same, for me at least, the same wider understanding that I want for science. Somebody cracked a little bit. Yes.
A little louder.
The idea that this whole explains this whole life affirming, and that it opens up possibilities of freedom. And I'm speaking from the spirituality of the beginning of the first 5 or 6 words of John Milton's poem, Samson Agonistic, where Samson is blind and is ready to knock down the tower. Words in that long poem are a few steps further onward.
Yes.
That's how Milton opens up a few steps further on.
A few steps further onward.
You said it for me beautifully. That's right.
Yeah.
That's what I believe in. A few steps on in, a little further. Thank you.
Yes. I'm going to take this with me. What if you said, I don't know where it's going, but it's an incredibly wonderful trip?
For sure. Did I say that? I'm glad. No, that is what I think. We're part of a fantastic show. Some of you, and here we are. Yes. Oh, well, you did get to it. Okay, that was the person. Yeah. The connection of it and the implicit
to the spiritual.
Okay.
And I guess, you know, by spiritual, but what do I mean? And more, it's like the universal forces that connect us all. And that's what I'm leaving with, something that I want to hear more.
Well, right away, what I would say is, I take her to say, the connection of the implicit and all that you said, to, and the way she said spiritual, I put in that. And then if you want to say it connects us all, I think that's right, sure. But if you don't first go to the implicit version of whatever you mean by spiritual, then I'm a little worried about it. But if you, I don't mean first. You can first say whatever you want, but then go to the actual this. Then it's real and it's there and it supports you, and it's a groundedness that's in you and is totally beyond question. If you define it, it gets very doubtful. What we define is so helpless. It's a little diagram that we make. And then we're supposed to worship that thing. It's almost all concepts are idolatry, I think, in the spiritual space. Unless you mean them as handles the way we're using them. So when I hear you say connects us all, I think, does that connect us all? Oh, yeah, sure, of course it connects us all. But if it's going to be an interhuman space that somebody's going to measure, like, then I don't know about that at all. Did that make sense?
Yes. And actually, because
Yes.
Tell you what it meant.
Yes.
So I think my
sense is bigger. Yes. If we can agree that however you were going to define it, it's bigger than that, then we don't have to define it. And if we do define it, it's fine. It's perfectly all right to define it.
Maybe three more comments and... Or two more comments.
Look at
maybe.
That.
Maybe we...
It's the right time to end, yes.
Perhaps others wear a third hat in the room, although I couldn't call myself a philosopher, but trained in psychotherapy and as a rabbi, I find there's a reciprocity of implicit that you're expressing at such a deep level that you create a philosophy of infinite hope. So that it's almost like a universal, it's not a theology, it's an ology that empowers all humans to be equal. And that's awesome to
me. Yeah.
Sure.
That's a wonderful last comment. Can we allow that to be the last comment?
Sure.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. Hope to see you at the reception at my place at 6 o'clock. Okay, I'll stay right there.